Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another edition of the Daniel Hendrick Experience. I am super glad you're here, and I'm really super happy about the guest that we have on for you today, tenor Ben Gulley. This guy's voice, ladies and gentlemen, as you will hear, is absolutely amazing. He sings a Di Quella Pira that we're going to play for you later that is just incredible. Power, aggressiveness, a real stentorian tenor with just easy high notes, yet power and bigness and beauty at the same time. And not only is this guy lighting up around the world in opera, but he crosses over and is an award-winning actor in Broadway shows as well. And on top of all of that, as if it's not enough, he is an amazing composer of popular music and singer. And how he can cross over into the genres is absolutely amazing. And I'm really looking forward to talking to Ben about how he's doing that. He just finished a Lucia di Lammermoor with our former guest, Marnie Breckenridge, to high acclaim, and we're excited to talk to him about that. So we're just going to jump right into it, ladies and gentlemen, and let's bring in this amazing, talented artist, tenor, composer, Mr. Ben Gulley.
Hello, hello. How you doing, brother?
He's here.
Yeah, great to meet you, first off.
Yeah, great to meet you, too. Wow. I am an extreme fan of yours now, man. How did your Lucia go?
It was incredible. It was about as good, about as great as a debut as a debut could go.
Excellent.
So, yeah, it's one of those for the first one, and a lot of friends and supporters and new folks and admins and everybody who came, they all came out and they couldn't believe it was my first one. So that was the best compliment I could ask for. And all the Italian speakers understood everything and said it was great. So yeah, that was really, really awesome. Marnie is such a peach. Honestly, I'm biased. You know, we're all guilty of loving whatever show we're part of at this but honestly, what an incredible something. It was one of those magic moments in Opera Orlando. Down in Orlando, there was some art that was rivaling every other art happening in the planet at that time. So
Isn't that beautiful?
Yeah, beautiful. Man, it was incredible. To hear, you know, I've been performing in Orlando like 14 years, and to see a crowd respond to opera like that was like a rock concert, was something really, it kind of, even just seeing the board members of the opera kind of look around at each other like, oh, the magic is here. Like the magic, we can get, you know, the community, like first timers really can go, oh my gosh. So it was amazing.
Wow. Well, I already did an intro for you. I got to tell you, I've done this is my second season now.
Congrats.
And I'm in like number 18 or 19 of the second season, right?
Oh, right on.
And guys like Ben Heppner and Chris Merritt and, you know, kind of legend.
You've had my buddy Stu Skelton on too. Yeah.
Yes. Right? Yeah. But I got to tell you, holy shit, when I heard your Di Quella Pira, I mean, I don't know if you know, but I'm a retired tenor myself, you know?
Yeah, absolutely, brother. I know that you're, yeah, absolutely.
And I'm just like, that guy is amazing. And then, because your top is so explosive, you know? And then when I heard you doing your original music, what style do you call that? Is it like R&B or jazz? Or
we've tried to make a box for the cat to sit in. I think neo soul, like blue eyed soul, is like neo soul pop would be maybe the new would be a term for it. So
that is.
But honestly, the title of that record is indicative in a lot of cases of who I am and how I feel. So it's called In Between because it's not a pop record. It's not theater music. It's not. And it's not rock and roll, it's not R&B, it's not, so it's something in between. So that's really what we found out doing that record, because I whittled down about 30 tracks of my own to those, and one of those is a cover. Most people don't recognize it immediately. That I'm Gonna Be is that Proclaimers hit from the 80s, the upbeat.
Oh my god.
It's been covered a couple other times. I wasn't first to market on hearing the genius of that song Slow Down, but yeah, that song Slow Down becomes the most amazing promise to a partner or a dance track you've. When I wake up, well, I know I'm gonna be the man who's waking next to you. Like, such beautiful lyrics, you know what I mean? So Slow Down, it becomes something else.
Ladies and gentlemen, what you just heard Ben do, and he did it so casually and fun, out of his soul, so relaxed, opera singers can't do that stuff. That
oh,
was
amazing. I hear you. I'm always pushing back on it, though. You know what I mean? Always because my trite. I'm so trite, but it's the same 12 notes.
Hey,
you know.
When I say opera singers can't do that, I mean it's exposing your amazing talent.
Oh,
right?
Thank you, brother.
To be able, and this I talked about in the intro about you, because I do like a crossover rock opera kind of stuff too, and I even co-wrote a rock opera ballet in Italy.
Awesome.
But what you're doing and your flexibility up there, I see the absolute link how you jumped tessitura wise into opera. Do you feel that way?
Yeah, I didn't. You know, you don't know what you're doing. I even equated to like cheering at sporting events.
Yes.
I wouldn't lose my voice. I didn't know what I was doing. Like I dabbled. I had some voice lessons in high school, but like if you had told me that I'd be chatting with Daniel Hendrick right now. About,
right.
You know, a career in opera that I still feel like I'm the baby. I'm the up and comer.
Yes.
You know, I've got some big dreams and mountains still to climb, but I'm in my man years now. So it's kind of exciting in that sense. But yeah, no, if you had told me that I'd be here yakking with you about a career in opera, I would have giggled in your face. But,
yeah.
You know, I always kind of looking back, you can see it because I was saying I never lost my voice at sporting events because I was always kind of always Danny Belcher supporting. I was always talking, as Danny Belcher says, talk on your talent. I was always keeping it in this resonant space and the whole time at sporting events and not knowing that, there's actually something, there was a technique in there that I didn't even realize was going to bear fruit years later in my life, you know? So
isn't that amazing?
For sure. But honestly, growing up singing in church and singing gospel music, that kind of taught me to sing out and outside of myself and for something bigger than the ego. And maybe that drew me into a little bit to what opera could be. So it's because I feel like really, well, now I'm getting into the soapbox already. I know we just started.
I'm loving it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I grew up a Pentecostal, man.
Oh, right on. Yeah. I'm a good old Baptist boy. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. The only difference was we rolled around on the floor and stuff. No,
that's
I'm kidding.
Right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
I'm
the Baptists
kidding.
Didn't want to get any wrinkles that I grew up with. Yeah, they're willing to get it dirty for the potato casserole after the service, but they weren't rolling around.
But folks, what I was saying for most opera singers, just to do something like Amazing Grace.
Yes.
That's a hard thing to do because
you're
trained to not do kind of off the voice kind of thing. And yet that's how I grew up playing with that stuff. But you do.
Yeah.
You're like that on steroids. You know, you remind me of the way Luther used to sing his top, you know?
Oh, that means that's funny. That's my whole life I've kind of been called the white chocolate Luther. So that's funny you said that. But no, I almost every interview, everything I've ever said, once it connected for me, I mean it. It's the same 12 notes.
And it is.
And we're all singing the same five vowels in every language across the planet. It's a version of them, but we're all singing, and whether it's Willie Nelson to Johnny Cash to Luciano to Barbara Streisand to Lady Gaga, it's the same five vowels and the same, in our Western ear, the same 12 notes.
Exactly.
It is that trite. It is that true.
How freaking cool, dude.
Yeah.
Wow. You know,
that's how I think about it.
Well, it sounds like it. It sounds like it. And when you view it that way, it becomes a lot more simplistic. You know, many years ago when I was coaching with my teacher in San Diego, George Travillo, he was hearing me sing Recondita Armonia of Tosca.
Yeah.
And he said, no, it sounds like you're imitating an opera singer. He said, sit down on the piano and sing to me one of your original songs.
Yes.
And I did.
Yes.
And he said, I want you to sing Recondita Armonia just like you wrote the song. Yep. And that totally changed my consciousness.
Yep. Yep. There was another, man, we're immediately going down the rabbit hole. But my buddy Nathan Graner, we're both Kansas City boys. I was one of the American tenors with him. Another incredible American tenor. Outside of being one of the American tenors, but he came up. I always looked up to him. He was, you know, he came up before me in the scene, and I came up, you know, a few years after him. But he had something great. I think he attributed it to Schubert. But Schubert had a quote of, "Present every time you get to perform music as the last time you ever get to do it, and the first time you've ever heard it or read it." And I'm like, that's another one. Like, we're just raising the stakes. It takes the pressure off. Then, you know what I mean? There's come to it new, but also with the passion that you may never, ever get to do it again. And I think there's a way that singing, there's a way to express inside that that makes the stakes so easy and attainable. I mean, I know that, yet again, it sounds so trite, but I think that's really the strength to all of us and what you're doing. When we tap into soulful singing, it's undeniable. I think that's the word that you can critique it, because opera is so good at critiquing and having an opinion. But honestly, how did the crowd feel? You know, and I love, that's another one. Maria Callas, she always has that quote too of, sometimes it is the singer's job to decide whether he wants or she wants to make the crowd happy or the maestro happy. You can rarely ever do both. And it was like, ooh, there's some knowledge there too, maestro. Like, there's some knowledge there too. Yeah.
When I made my debut at City Opera, I'm dating myself. How old?
Yeah.
I sang the opera Mephistopheles, right?
Oh, it's so incredible. That finale. One of the best in the whole rep. Oh.
Well, I was singing the aria, Dai I campi, dai I prati, in the very first act, right? And it's my debut in New York, and I go to the B-flat at the end, and I hold it super long, right?
Yes.
And I'm like, it was that moment. Do you want to please the conductor? Or do you want to please the audience, or do you want to please yourself, right? But I was so into the art and the passion that I held it really long. And Christopher, the conductor, who was also the head of the opera company, slammed his baton down on the podium and broke his baton. So he conducted the whole next act with a broken baton.
That's how good that's how good it was. You broke it. You Jedi'd his baton. That wasn't his fault. You did that. Yeah, that's amazing. Oh, that's awesome. Oh, I love that.
Well, I paid a price for that, but...
Oh, I've had some funny moments. Yeah, I did a T-flat in Sarasota 7 years ago, and Maestro David Neely was conducting that. Fantastic. And he was so impassioned in the final scene right before I'm about to snap the neck of the bad guy as the hero Pedro. And right when I do that, there's a gasp through the audience when that moment happens, but then immediately laughter. And I didn't understand. In his passion, when he went to give the cue, launched his baton and hit the heroine on stage 30 feet away. It was so impassioned that the audience was laughing, but at the heightened moment of the show. So yet again, you never know. You never know what's really going on in the sausage at an opera.
That's amazing. So, yeah. So I've been studying your album that you have, which I'm gonna buy today, by the way. So
appreciate it, brother.
No, my wife was like, "Who is that?" This morning, my wife's from Mexico, and I'm like, "This is the guy that sings opera." She's like, "Oh my god, I love that!" I'm like, "I'm buying it," because your creativity, the genius behind—I mean, singing is one thing, composing. Did you do the arrangements too for your?
I did, yeah. And my buddy, I had a music director on a couple of my national tours, Jesse Lynch. He's a collaborator of mine, incredible pianist and composer in his own right. But yeah, they're all my originals, and then he and I would kind of flesh out and trade off arrangement and what flavors need to go where.
Okay, gotcha.
What musicians need to come on this and which session? Yeah, so. It was collaboration for sure, but it's all at the end of the day, it's all Van Gullies. So
that's awesome. Now, hearing you from a teacher's perspective and a tenor, and I'm hearing the fluency that you have above the passaggio, which is unusual with somebody with as big as of a voice that you have, right?
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, did you grow up, you said you grew up in a Baptist church. Was it a black Baptist church?
I did grow up singing black Baptist music. Yeah, it was, gospel music, American gospel music. So all the Winans, I grew up, all the bishops, everybody was feeling that too. So yeah, that's why it was part of the, when I joked about being called the White Luther, that was kind of sing it white boy. It was a lot of my childhood. So.
Yes.
But even my godmother in high school and my, the football player and the college coach, Scorpio Horn, was one of my dear friends in high school, and we'd go sing at the Christian Tabernacle, and we had some great memories together.
That's awesome. I have a t-shirt that I wear that says, oops, sorry folks, it says, I'm the white boy that plays the funky music.
I love it. That's so funny. Oh, that's so funny.
It sounds like you could have one of those shirts, right?
Oh, yes. Right. Absolutely.
So that was your beginning, and probably just intuitively you found how to sing that upper register. Did you feel like you were mixing falsetto in the early days with that?
No, so I didn't know I had a top. But yet again, I can look back in hindsight and know that I was exploring my top at sporting events. But I didn't know. No, if you had heard me singing, I sang off the voice and really sweet. Like I was in state choir and stuff, but I sang bass. When I started officially studying voice in college, I was a baritone. And it was one of those fluky Michael Cousins, if you know that name, the incredible tenor. He was also said, one of the best. I was fortunate enough to have my first year in the conservatory with him before he retired. And he planted that little seed of looking at me. He'd just sit there behind, you know that reticence you have as a teacher to classify, to tell the cat which box they fit in, you know what I mean? Because if you're wrong for a little bit, oh no, identity crisis. It means so much to young singers. What am I? What kind of tenor am I? Uh-huh. What fuck will I be? Like, calm down, everyone.
Who do I sound like?
But because of that, Michael actually, Michael's one of the few, yet again, we've all got our stories, but his claim, he's one of the few artists that ever won the Met competition, not the LaFont competition, but won the Met competition as a baritone, and then 3 years later, won it as a tenor. Yes, Michael Cousins. Look it up.
I didn't realize that.
One of the only times that's ever happened. There's another, I think there was another one in the 80s. But Michael was one of the first and only times that someone won it as a baritone, and they allowed him to come back as another voice type because he moved to Germany after he won as a baritone, started working on his language, and his teacher went, "Hombre, you've got an extension that's really comfortable. You can actually live up there. You can't just touch them. You can hang out up there." And so he did. And so Michael would sit. We'd get done with lessons with my Schubert art song or whatever. And he'd get done and he'd sit there and just kind of look, rub his chin and sip his Diet Coke and just go, I don't know. I didn't know what that was. Till finally, right before he was about to retire, a couple lessons before, he's like, "You may be a tenor. I think you may be a tenor." And it was that little seed that gets planted where you're like, wait, what? What does that mean? What does that really mean? And then I got Dale Morehouse came to faculty at UMKC at the conservatory. And he was really, he's the one that I can, the shepherd that everybody can blame for really not, this is the greatest compliment I can give him, for not getting in my way. He really, I didn't know what he was doing. And in hindsight, he was allowing me to find my artistry. And from that improv state, that creative state, that compositional state of just say yes, Dale was letting me explore and discover that I'm not just an opera singer, that I'm not just a pop singer, I'm a singer. It's all singing. It's all expressing. It's all. And yet again, going back to what we talked about, it's the same 12 notes, but how you go from style to style. It's just how you imbue the vowel. It's the color that you imbue that vowel and those words with, and the part of you that you access that you want to get out in the sound waves. That's only the difference. That's why I think opera at its finest causes people to jump like they're at a Beatles concert, up screaming, not understanding a word even of Italian or Russian or French or Chinese or anything, and they have to have an emotional response back and clap and scream bravo and cry.
Yeah.
It's not happening a lot, and that's my challenge to everybody, because we all know the power of opera, but that's not always happening right now.
Of course not.
Opera's kind of going, but wait, but we're opera. And I'm looking around with hubris, with the hubris, and saying, don't be great just because you're told you're great. We have to prove our greatness again. We have to really go back out and anyway, that's I'm going down another rabbit hole, but
preach yeah, it, brother. Preach
yeah,
it.
Yeah, man.
Yes.
It all goes back to that place of what we're talking about. When you go to the edge, what makes you hold that high note even longer? You were willing to go to your edge and maybe even just a little bit beyond that comfort spot, because that's where opera should exist. And I may have just upset so many academic safe teachers that express their Mozart healthfully and medicinally. But at the end of the day, you got to let the stallion out of the hold, you know, you got to let him run. Yeah.
And you, my friend, definitely do that. And if you don't mind, I would like to play for the audience a bit of your Di Quella Pira.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Folks, this is not common, what you're going to hear.
I got to tell you, he feels like one of those calling cards. I got to do him with Maestro James Albritton at Piedmont Opera when Tashina Vaughn is my mother. I was a chain a couple months ago. And man, he's one of my glove roles. He'll be one of my five. But Manrico feels so incredible. Like,
yeah, I bet.
Yet again, it's one of those roles that everybody's so scared of. Such a treat to sing. It's so good. It feels so healthy. So, yeah, I'm giddy.
Wow.
I'm excited for the future.
And Tashina has been on the podcast as well.
Oh, amazing. Amazing. She's so incredible. What an icon.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, here we go. Di Quella Pira. Fasten your seatbelt. No, you didn't. Oh,
so much fun.
My. And you actually sang an eval on that top high C.
Right? Yeah, and I've taken that shadow vowel out now. A lot of me, yeah, I've taken that guy out. Yeah, for sure.
Oh, my God. And what I love about you is I can hear the influence of your church singing in that, because you're able to do things that normally they teach tenors, you don't do that. But it's so healthy, the way that you do it in the passaggio, you know? It's just so free.
Yeah.
So free.
Yeah.
It's a little bit more open on the Fs than normally you would hear somebody sing. And that's my teacher for a long time was Giuseppe Di Stefano, you know.
Oh, amazing. He's the king. Yeah.
Yes.
As much as people could critique him, also, is that not one of the most amazing sounds wide open when he was?
Yeah.
Sure. I heard there's another great. Yeah, I'm full of. We're all. I know after years in this career, we're all full of these tropes and sayings and anecdotes.
Right.
But who was? I'm trying to think of his name. He did a master class at conservatory. He was one of Pavarotti's pianists. North American one. Oh, what's his name?
Was it John?
Yes, John. Give me his last name.
Wasserman.
Yes, it was. Yes, exactly. And we had a great master class, and you know, blah blah blah. We were charmed by one another. And he comes up to me afterwards. He goes, "I want to give you a little bit of advice that I didn't want to give everybody in the master class because not everybody deserves this." And I was like, "What?" And he goes, "Spend your interest and not your capital." And when he's like, when you're singing, he grabbed me a couple seconds later. He's like, but one day you're going to learn that you can spend your capital. You just need to know how much you can spend at a time. Exactly. And I didn't know what that meant until you get a little old and you start getting into this rep that calls something a little, you know, you go to that edge and go right beyond a little bit. And you get a little more superhuman sometimes is what I like to think.
So many of the people out there are not necessarily vocal people, and they're not going to know what you meant about spend your interest. Can you explain that?
Yeah, when you're singing, we all know as a singer that there's pacing involved to perform, and this is not an insult. I'm gonna explain this through something that's really concise. Andrea Bocelli sings opera, but he is not an opera singer.
Yes,
and I say that because learning to pace yourself for some of the hardest acrobatics and orchestrations that you have to overcome and achieve without microphone amplification for 3 hours to 5 hours, from Wagner to Verdi to Donizetti to any of these, you have to have some ability and some muscular achievement and some athleticism to know how far you can take yourself. And if you're revving the gas all race, you're going to run out of gas real quick. Opera singers have to learn how to pace the race, because you don't get to stop and refuel. You really don't.
Yes.
We've got to learn to get to an end of that opera. And by the end of that, it costs every artist something. It sounds so dramatic, but it's true. It costs us something to go onto that stage. And it's our energy. We don't always talk about it with each other. What are we expending? We're expending our soulful energy when we step out onto a stage.
Absolutely. Hopefully we are.
And sometimes if we aren't aware of it, we can overspend and we can go too far. And we've got, oh no, I have a whole act to go. And I spent all my energy already, meaning I'm tired, meaning I'm stressed, meaning my vocal cords are high. You know, no matter how many times you swallow, you can't get your cords to go back down. So it's, you know, that's what I mean by the knowledge that eventually you learn, oh, I'm going to sing on interest in this duet.
Yes.
And then I'll spend a little capital on that aria. And then, you know.
Yes. My coach that I told you about, George, who played for Björling for many years, by the way.
Oh, amazing.
He told me in one of those coaching sessions, he said, he used to call me Danny. Danny, you sing every aria as if the whole thing is an orgasm. And he said, you have to save it for the end.
Yeah. And it's something when I go back and everybody's got their favorites, but when I go back and when I'm just being a fan of opera and I go back to listen to Pavarotti, sorry, I get yelled at for not saying his full name. But when I go back and listen to Pavarotti, there's his parlando in so much of everything. He's just talking it.
Right.
You don't even realize it. And you're like, oh, it's what a beautiful. Oh, he's only singing maybe 30% of the time, especially in Bel Canto. He's just placing it and saying it right in the pitch. You know, it's like,
yes.
And it saves the voice. And you're like, how could he do those ones? Because he was always just staying supple. And then he's going into he's going into the bell. We can all study each other. But at the end of the day, you got to end up just being Hendrick. You just got to be Gully. You just got to be Björling. You just got to be. That's another thing that I think's happened, at least personally, the last few years, is that I've. Those moments in your career when you stop, like you said, stop parroting or stop trying to be something else or be what you aren't, and you self-realize and go, oh, I'm Gully now. I'm, you know what I mean? Yeah, that doesn't sound like anybody else. I'm not singing this like anybody else. This is This is my interpretation. It's my path now, you know. It's a powerful day when you stop asking for permission, you know.
There you go, day. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
And there's always the voices out there telling you the way that you're doing it is not the way. And yep. so-and-so didn't do in that way, and whatever, right?
Know thyself. Part of what I said, when I broke away from Dale, but part of Dale's beauty was he taught the mindset of know how to make every sound both good and bad so that you don't need me anymore, that I'm become my own voice teacher. And that was a superhero ability that he gave me that I'm really grateful for.
Wow,
too.
That's a big gift.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
You're talking about singing it. When I was singing Butterfly in New York, I went next door to the Met to have lunch, which when you're at City Opera, you get to go into the Met.
Oh, I love that cantina. I've got lunch down there. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so I'm there, and I hear that Tosca rehearsal is going to happen with Pavarotti. So I sneak into the back of the Met, totally empty, and I'm like, he's not going to sing, right? This is rehearsal. And I'm hearing the singers. I could tell they're way over there on the stage, but I could hear them. Pavarotti walks out, and he's like, Dammi colori. And it just jumps off of the stage, and it feels like he's right in front of me, as opposed to the other singers with big voices.
Yes.
But he had that ability just to be talk singing, and it was just so present.
Yeah.
And I tell my students this all the time. Big isn't necessarily loud. It's about, does it carry? And my God, your voice has that squealo in it, right?
Yeah, and it's funny because I've also disappointed people who have, as a bigger guy, you know, I've lost 200 pounds from where I was years ago. Still got a few more to lose. But being as big as I was and having the voice that I've had at the age that I had it, we all hear this as a big person with a big instrument. Everybody's like, you're a baby Heldon. And I was freaking out the whole time because I'm like, I'm way too young. I don't know that. And it's not true. I'm obviously not. You know what I mean? And so you end up kind of singing stuff you really shouldn't sing or not. But also that becomes its own blessing because you are miscast for a minute. You kind of have to find yourself and get to know yourself a little more, especially when you're like, I'm singing stuff and it doesn't feel right. So, you know, God's got a sense of humor, that's for sure. Because I was supposed to have made my Tristan debut this last November in Brussels in concert. But I got sick as a dog for almost all of, after Thanksgiving, for all of Christmas. And I was like, I'm not going to go sludge my way through the hardest, the hardest thing for the tenor voice, you know, the Ubermann. I'm not going to go do it sick.
Good so for you.
It was
brother.
A good lesson because, truthfully, I went on and did my Romeo my Romeo debut right after that, and my voice has gone through some crazy rep this year. Getting Tristan was ready to go, but it was wild to go from Tristan down to Gounod, and now just back to Donizetti, to Lucia, to fresh and buoyant, and it's so. Most people would say, you know, a couple of my mentors, I got cursed out, admittedly. People were like, what the hell are you doing, Ben? Like, you're being crazy. Part of it is, you know, you're young and you take the work you take when you take it. So, but also...
Happened to me, yep.
But also, this season proved, not only did I succeed, but the season that shouldn't have happened has happened, and it's been brilliant and flying colors from Manrico to... Carmina Burana's to Verdi Requiem's to Romeo Juliet's to Tristan to Lucia it all is in the wheelhouse. You know, there's like tenors like Michael Spire right now who are proving it. He's doing that baritenor stuff. It's the mold is shattered. Larry Brownlee shattered the mold too. Yeah.
Absolutely. And that's why categorizing someone as something can really limit consciousness. And then now immediately, I can only do ba ba ba.
Yeah, especially in opera, which is such an quote unquote. This is not an insult to our amazing art form, but to an established high art that doesn't need to justify itself anymore. That's my joke. That's what that challenge. I'm like, don't be fancy just because you're known to be fancy. Why are we fancy? Oh, because it was supposed to be the world's greatest union of the live arts all coming together to tell. Right.
Exactly.
A story that could transcend time. Anyway.
Yes.
But I say that because that is kind of, yet again, that is the kind of the mission we're all on right now.
Yeah, George used to, the same coach used to always tell me, you give too much respect to opera, meaning you're so afraid of it to not do it the right way,
yes.
to be explorative with your approach, right?
Yep.
And he kept trying to tell it, make it your own. And you're doing that big time. And kudos.
Oh, thanks, brother.
Yeah.
There's another saying too, first to market, first to slaughter. And trailblazers are always the one that go through it.
Well,
so it's been a little bit of that.
Back in 2000, when I kind of retired from the opera scene because of a divorce, I started writing an album, and I came out with this album, rock opera kind of thing. And man,
awesome.
was I trashed by the opera community for doing
oh,
that.
Oh sure,
right?
Oh sure. I feel like a lot of the time I have like two masks. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. And I remember being on a plane going to Baltimore to sing Macbeth. And I had the score, and this lady said, "Oh, are you a musician?" I said, "No." Mm-hmm. Are you a conductor? No. Are you an opera singer? No. She said, "Well, then why do you have the score?" And I said, "Well, I sing opera." She said, "But you said that you're not an opera singer." I said, "I'm not. I sing opera. That's not who I am."
Oh, I love that. Yeah, for sure.
I also have kids. I also have a wife. But that's not who I am. And
I always joke. Yeah. Oh, go ahead, brother.
That's not who you are, because if that's your whole identity, what happens if you lose your voice? Does that mean you don't exist anymore?
Preach.
You know, it's like the Bible. I am that I am, right? I am that
yes.
I am.
Yeah. I always joke when it's one of the last few careers that when you announce it to strangers or even people who know you, there's a weird immediate respect already. Like, oh, it's like same thing as doctors, politicians, and lawyers. They go, oh, and the religious and the clergy. Oh. And so I always joke, I'm like, don't give me any respect until you heard me sing. Because people who say they sing opera a lot of times are like, oh, yes, they like that aloof. There's a reason that caricature exists, you know what I mean? There's
yes.
a self-imposed importance that we're
yes.
all the quote-unquote best at something in the world. What is that to who?
Uh-huh.
To your mom, because you know what I mean? What matters at the end of the day? Yeah.
All of a sudden, you're smarter.
Yeah. And this is not an insult. We've all got a lot of our operatic celebrity friends, or even feel operatic famous sometimes.
Yes.
But being a famous opera singer in the modern era is being like a famous plumber.
There you go.
Renee Fleming can shop at Target.
Yes.
And that's not an insult. That's just
where we are in society.
That's where we are in society right now.
That is awesome.
Yeah,
hey,
how lucky that we get to do it, though.
Amen to that, man. So tell me, you were raised in the church, and have there been times when you were on stage singing where you felt almost like an out-of-body experience, like you were one with God, the divine, with the universe, or have you ever felt any sort of transcendent experience?
Yeah, well, that's what, yet again, not to sound so trite and true, that's what I'm kind of always trying to do. I'm always trying to achieve that flow state of, it's why we rehearse so hard and passionately and be willing to fail. It's because you have to find, yet again, you find that pace, find an artistic safe place in the performance. That's what I've got my own mantra and prayers before I go on stage, but I've got a mindset kind of transcends religion in that sense. It's very much what you just said. But there's I'm trying to remember who told me this. It was a minister friend years ago, but he was researching the Hebrew, and the Hebrew for glorify actually translate closer to the verb to mirror. And so it just hit me like a lightning bolt of, oh, when you're glorifying something, you're mirroring it. So if you love the beauty or the power of a piece of music, you can glorify that piece of music by mirroring its beauty and something back to someone else by sharing it. And then that beauty usually strikes them, and now they're mirroring and glorifying that piece.
Yes.
And it becomes cyclical. And I think, yet again, you can hear me tiptoeing around this. When society admits and sees that church and theater are one and the same, there is a holistic union at how we should approach each other and how we should approach how we think about things. because I think what people are going to the theater to watch people lying to tell the truth.
Mm-hmm.
What are you going to church for?
Mm-hmm.
The opposite of that. Philosophically, the opposite of that.
Yes.
Someone telling the truth to heal our lies is what you go to church for. But when you go to theater, you're wanting to watch people lie to tell the truth. So I think,
interesting perspective.
Ben Gully is that heavy. When I'm going on stage, it really is my challenge to be a conduit to try to tell a story effectively and honestly. Because even on the inverse of that, the selfish side is that if we can, you've been there, you felt it. When we get done with an incredible night of theater, there's nothing better than it. It's when, like, and this is, yet again, a cheesy Gully trope. I challenge anybody, what's the greatest feeling in the world? There's cute little smirky answers. There's the middle school answers. There's the young adult answers. But the truth is, the greatest feeling in the world is aha. Oh, understanding one another, understanding a concept, understanding a new art form, understanding where that character came from, understanding what the poetry really meant in that moment. Aha. And I think the greatest moments alive are when we are come together, usually at a theater, usually at a church, usually at a music festival, usually at a political rally, when we all collectively go, aha. And it happens in a breath, because I say this in interviews too. The second greatest feeling we all feel as an opera singer, when you're on in that moment and you're not faking it, you're not missing a beat, you're in the moment, you're in the flow, and you cut off in character and you go and breathe in informational breath for your next phrase, and you hear 50, 500, 50,000 people go with you. Oh, it's the greatest feeling. It's that aha moment. That's what it is. So I feel like that's genuinely, you can't act for that. You can't prepare for that, but you can try to get the audience glorifying with you to get to that state. That's what I feel. Yeah, that's the stakes of what we do. I see you smiling and nodding too. So it's ubiquitous.
Dude. I mean, God breathed the breath of life into Adam. Breath is life, man. And
inspiration, of God. Yeah.
And when you can be there in an opera house or any setting for that matter, and people in the audience start breathing with you, and
nothing better.
And then they become, in a sense, one, and you're, by you being the empty vessel, allowing the divine to go through you, all of a sudden, they're tasting the hem of that garment a little bit, you know?
That's called the aha. Yes, that's the collective aha. That is, oh, I understand you. I understand it. You understand me. I feel seen. I see. Yeah, that's the power. That's really what I think we're trying to do.
So early in my studying days, I was like 19 or 20, I started singing at an Italian restaurant in Palm Springs called Mario's.
Yes, awesome.
Opera restaurant. And all I heard about when I was first there, exactly, right? All I heard about was this guy that used to sing there named Armando Sierra. Armando was so great. So I became jealous at that time of Armando. And I'm like, oh, he can't be that good. And so one day, about a year later, I'm going towards the bathroom and I hear this voice. And I'm like, oh my God, coming out of the bathroom, warming up. And I walk in and my eyes start to water. And I'm hearing I'm looking at this short Mexican guy. And I'm watching him vocalize, and I totally had that aha moment, and I just like, I have never heard anything like that in my life.
And you said Ben Heppner earlier, you've had him on the show.
Yes, I have.
He was and is my idol. He's singing with me when I sing. He's the first voice that I heard when I started studying opera. That my teacher gave me his record, one of his opera arias records.
Okay.
And the first sound I heard him make, it was one of those empathetic, like, oh, oh, oh,
right.
That all makes sense. Oh, I know how you're doing this. I literally know what you're doing to do this. And it's beautiful and healthy and so open.
And natural.
And then I went and had some lessons with Bill Neal and understood what the technique was behind it and went, oh, So, you know, we've been friends on Facebook.
Wow.
We've reached out back and forth. We've had many banter, but it's amazing when your idols, like I said, once you find your medicine, when you find your access point, your hook to get into it. It made sense when I heard Ben sing, and it's Ben's fault that I really got into the repertoire. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
You know, he talked about on the show, singing on your interest, right? And then he said, yeah, but every once in a while, I would just have to push on that gas pedal a little bit. And he said, but I only knew when I could do that, but I couldn't push it all the time. But there were moments where the moment just told you have to do it, and it was okay.
And that's when I also say shame on our opera media, because those stories are not the ones that are heralded. It's the failures and things that are really wanted that they write about and things. But the truth is, it's those moments when our heroes and our colleagues, we all press the gas a little bit on that Sunday matinee at the end of the contract because we didn't have to sing again. We didn't know the next time we were doing that often sometimes. So you end up, is it not the Sunday matinee that's always a little more wonky or a little more special?
Yeah.
And so it's so funny. It's like those are the ones where I think have changed people's lives and made lifelong patrons have been some of those shows where we all were willing to go a little further than we thought were comfortable. And it made an audience member go, that's what's at stake. If I come to an opera, I can feel a human go that far. Oh, I want to go to the next one and see what they do. And then guess the disappointment that happens if you produce an opera and none of your artists went on stage and did it at those stakes, and they present a really safe, light buffo or something, you know, which has its own place too. But if those actors didn't go out there, that person that just came back to that opera is going to be disappointed and go, that's the challenge. That's the challenge. Yeah.
Well, young fellow, I am now a official fan in your fan club.
Back at you, brother. Back at you, man.
So you were said something earlier about American tenors.
Yeah.
Was that a group or something you were in? Or?
There was a group. Yeah, they had the big special. It was Sony. There, it was before Peter Gelb moved on to and ran the Met. It was one of his last projects at Sony Masterworks. I wasn't one of the original members. The original three were Nathan, Graner, Daniel Montenegro, and Mexican American. Oh, I'm going to miss his name. What is? I cannot think of his name. I can hear his voice, but I cannot think of his name. Him. And then the world tour started happening. Had their big special at the Kodak Center on PBS. Frank McNamara, he was like the Paul Schaefer of Ireland. He created the Irish tenors.
Okay.
And so then this was his spin-off group in the early 2000s.
And you were in that?
I joined 2009 through 2014 and sang all the American hits across the planet. So had a good time doing that. Yeah, it was really, really, really incredible experience.
Amazing. How cool is that? So Ben Heppner was kind of like your hero and idol, right?
Yeah, yeah. And then getting to study with Bill was absolutely amazing too. Study with him for a few weeks was one of the, you get it. It's hard once you start performing. It's hard to stick around too long anywhere and stay studying with somebody. Once you start performing, you know, it's hard to stop.
So. When you're doing your original music and then you go and sing, let's say, opera in the next day, technically, is there anything different for you? Pause.
No. Oh, genuinely, man. No.
I so love that you said that.
Yeah. It's one of those I don't want to ever. Yeah, no, nothing's different. And honestly, even on my tours, that yet again, we talk about the only word we can really use, my agent and I, is that it is a trailblazing. It is its own. Doesn't make any sense. Nobody before now really could genuinely tell the public, hey, come to my concerts. I'm going to do some opera arias, but we're also going to do some music theater. I know. And some jazz. And some pop, and I'm going to pull out my ukulele towards the end of the night, and we're going to do some pop covers. Yeah, that's what I do all across the country. I've done
that.
Most
is
of my fans are 70 and older, but that's my, you know, that's who's coming to shows too. So that's been my mission. That's been my access. or my word is access. I want this incredible art form that we have to be accessed. And if that is through me doing a John Denver song or my own original music or Cab Calloway or singing Ragtime or Les Mis, whatever those hooks are that got you to come to live art,
wow,
then that's what it is. Yeah.
And you won some awards as well for like the Broadway stuff, right?
Yeah, so that's been an incredible one. Dennis DeYoung, yet again, one of those tenors that taught us all how to sing diphthongs. And I teased him to his face about that. He wrote his version of Hunchback of Notre Dame in 97 when Styx and he fell apart, or not fell apart, but went separate ways. He was touring the world as Pontius Pilate in Jesus Christ Superstar, the great Dennis DeYoung of Styx fame.
Mm-hmm.
And he started writing his Victor Hugo version, adaptation of Hunchback of Notre Dame. And in our version, there are no gargoyles that save the day. There are no singing edifices. Mm. It's the true-to-life adaptation, Esmeralda's Dead in My Arms. I was his Quasimodo, is why I speak with possession, because it's... When I got the voicemail, I thought I was getting pranked from Dennis, actually. It's one of those, him being just goofy. He's like, I found you. You are Quasimodo. And I remember calling my wife at the time and be like, is that a compliment? I just got Quasimodo. But I didn't know. I got sent the music. The director is just one of my dearest and favorite people, Michael Unger. And Dennis wrote one hell of a show. I'm biased, of course, but it's like the long lost 90s power musical. And we workshopped it in at Skylight Music Theater about a year and a half ago. And we won, I think it was 53 out of 56 Broadway World Awards.
And I won
every award you could for it. And honestly, I don't say that egotistically. I say that just because I got to present Quasimodo, yes, in Dennis's show, and we did it honor. And it was Janet Metz was the Mayette. Alana Sophia from American Idol, she was the Esmeralda. Tony Award winning Kevin Anderson was my dad. So it was one of those, Milwaukee got something, and Dennis was there for the entire rehearsal period.
Wow.
And stayed for every show. So a lot of people talk about some of those rock gods, how much ego they play. No, Dennis was actually there standing in the back watching every single show because he loved it and cared for it so much.
Mm.
We all felt that. That was the stakes. So yet again, man, I say that because there's so much good art, and whether it's opera or music theater, I love telling a good story. I love getting to sink my teeth into something that's really artistically nutritious. You know what I mean? It's...
Wow, dude.
Yeah, so that's been incredible to also do that. And there's hopes that still goes to West End and Broadway. So we're taking it as we go. You know, whether I have to turn down the Met for Broadway or Broadway for the Met, then we'll have to see. Some of these houses will have to dance. But that's kind of the trajectory that I'm on.
Wow. I love your consciousness about it, because there's this phrase I always use for my students. Said, you want to have a career. You want to make sure that a career doesn't have you.
Yes.
And it sounds exactly that, like that is what you're doing.
Yeah. And it's funny because I may get in trouble in my life for being too candid, but I'd rather be too candid than not have said it at all. You know what I mean? In that sense. So I think so much of this career is we only get five roles.
Yeah.
You know, if you really want to have that crazy, at the end of the day, with all the photos on the wall, feeling self-happy, meeting your maker, that I've achieved all the goals I wanted to. You know what I mean? Because really, what's making it at the end of the day? You know, you've already sung it, and then you sing at Rome, and you go, uh-oh, I just sang at Mascala. I got to sing, Sydney next. And then you sing at Sydney. Oh, no. Eventually, you've sung everywhere. You know what I mean? So if I can have sung everywhere and meet my maker, that would be pretty amazing in that sense. But at the end of the day, it's just another opera, you know, just another chance.
Wow. Well, I got a feeling Jesus is looking down at you right now and saying, you're rocking it, son. Keep going.
Oh, I appreciate it. I hope so. I'm trying. Yeah. I try to not own it too much.
Yeah. You're doing great, man. Wow. So your next performance is what coming up?
I leave in 4 days for San Jose, for Symphony San Jose, and we've got a couple performances of Passionate Puccini Which is about a 3-hour concert and maybe more opera singing than any opera ever written. So, because we're doing pretty much the greatest hits of every Puccini opera, starting from Edgar Lavilli to everything else. So, yeah, it just keeps going. So,
You're not going to do Nessun Dorma. I bet you're not.
Oh, we're doing Nessun Dorma and the finale. Donna non vidi mai, Tutto Amore. Yeah, Tutto Amore, the finale of Turandot, E Luce Van. Oh my gosh, just go down the list. Yeah, it's gonna be home run after home run. So Che Gelida, O Suave, so all the hits.
Love those.
And then I make my Carmina Burana debut, singing those big high D's and high C's a couple days after that at Orchestra Iowa.
So wow.
I fly back home, go to Cedar Rapids, and then at the end of the month I'm doing a concert out in Carmel Valley. And then I'm taking all of June off. So
when you say Carmel Valley, where are you talking about? California or
California? Yeah, absolutely.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah,
I'm from California. Yeah, I'm from San Diego. So.
Oh, incredible! Yeah, the Monterey Carmel scene—they've become like a second home for me in a lot of ways. So, you know, I've kind of annually perform out there now.
Nice.
Specifically, there's Peter Meckel, who runs an incredible arts organization, GEM. Out there called the Hidden Valley Music Seminars. And did you ever work with Stuart Robertson? Did you ever work with Maestro? Oh,
no.
Well, he just passed away a few months ago, rest in peace. But he had a really heavy hand in helping out the music program at Hidden Valley too. But it's an incredible town. Alan Silvestri's there. So there's lots of fun out there.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's got his winery. When he's not writing hits, he's got his winery out there.
That's awesome.
Yeah,
I got to tell you, this is a story that someone like you would do. I was singing Boheme in Vancouver, and
awesome. They
had me on their like PBS equivalent of the radio, and we're at about a half an hour into the interview, and then the interviewer says to me, "So, who are your favorite composers?" I'm singing Boheme, right? Of course,
right.
I love Puccini. That was the main thrust of my career. And I'm thinking to myself, shit, should I tell him the truth about what I really love, like on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah.
And I'm struggling, and I say, okay, say it. And I said, Billy Joel, Elton John, and Andrew Lloyd Webber.
Yes.
The guy's face went blank.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But I did it. That's who I love to listen to, right? So.
Well, that's what I giggle. So I... Not to judge our friends, but so many of our colleagues, you know, and I get it. When you come from a symphonic world, your face is always in a score. When you're doing 50, when you're doing 50 to 100 performances of new music a year, I get it. You don't have a lot of time to be outside of your score.
Right.
But you have to be a full human. I will judge a little bit. So I've got some friends, without saying names, there's a certain famous maestro whose name rhymes with Bagano. And I've worked with him a few times, and I've always teased because when I try to have small talk with them or pop culture references, zing, zing, nothing.
Wow.
Nothing, because they don't have a concept outside of what they love, which is, that's a beautiful life too.
It is.
But
yeah.
I almost buck all of them to be like, go find a passion, it's just your work too. You know what I mean? Find a hobby or an expression.
Yes.
Because I feel like it makes you a better artist to go outside of your art form to take it. It's like traveling. You learn how to appreciate home more. People think going on vacation is all about just going and seeing the sights. It is, but it's also about coming back home and be like, oh man, I got it good. Or maybe I want this too. You know, anyway, man, I didn't mean to be so philosophical today, but as you're getting to know me, I seem to always point my sails always towards
I'm
what it's all
loving
about, so.
It, man. Loving it. Well, but that's been the story of my life and career too. So throughout, you probably don't know, but early in my career, I was with DiStefano at a competition in Italy and I lost my voice. And it took me 8 years until it came back and I made my debut at Lincoln Center. So I wrote a book about it called Know You Know. And I had all of these like spiritual out-of-body experiences and stuff. Wow. And so that's the story of my book, which, by the way, 2 weeks ago, I just signed a contract for the screenplay of my life story. So
awesome. Good for and you, brother. That's great.
All about this interaction of faith, holding on to what you know. And, dude, you are demonstrating that in your life. Because you're breaking the paradigms that say you can't do this. You can't cross over. You can't do that. And you're like, you know what? God gave me this gift. And it didn't have a sticker on it that said opera singer.
And everyone we respect at the end of the day is usually only doing what they love to do because they're inspired to. Because if you're just doing it for other performative reasons or what, like, it's a crude word, but it's just masturbation at that point. Yeah. Nobody wants to go see that. You could be the world's greatest, whatever. But you know what I mean? If there's no truth to the audience, there's no story to tell them or share.
Yeah.
You know, it's another trope. And that's what I always think. My mom, this is a mama gully. Whenever I'm checking my ego or bucking my ego, or I'm whining about something or how hard the job is or how lonely you get sometimes on the road, my mom will say, honey, remember you sing for free. They pay you to travel.
There you go.
You're right. I wake up singing every day of my life. I'm not going to let any cranky maestro or director or costume or anything take this away from me. Yeah, wow. I sing for free. They pay us to travel. Yeah. Man. Yeah, they pay us to be memorized. That's the real truth.
Right?
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's the real truth. Yeah.
Have that all down.
Wow. Yeah, exactly.
Well, my brother, can't believe an hour just flew by like that.
I can't believe it was such a pleasure, man. We got to do it again sometime.
Absolutely. And please stay in touch. And
yes. Now, what part of the country are you in? Where's home for you?
You know, right now I live in Phoenix. We moved here 3 years ago.
Oh my gosh.
Okay. But literally right now my house is up for sale and we're moving to San Miguel de Allende, Mexico.
No way, Daniel, that's awesome.
So excited about that.
Good for you, brother. Oh, that's great.
It's a city of art, music. My wife's a painter.
Just be there for
that's it.
For sunset there? Oh, that's amazing.
That's it.
Well, hey, if you got an extra bedroom, I'm going to come visit now because I've always wanted to go. I've always wanted to go.
Are you kidding me? Oh, we're going to have some jam sessions, man, sitting at the piano.
Man, I would love that. Yes, sir. Absolutely.
There you go, man. Yeah. Well, Ben, what a pleasure. Tell everybody where they can find you online.
Oh, yeah. It's Ben Gully, BENGULLEY. Everybody forgets the E, like a gully washer. But if you go to bengully.com, we've got up-to-date stuff going there. But I'm with the incredible Bob Quintana of Quintana Arts Management. You can find all my music on Spotify or Instagram. You can on Instagram, actually. But iTunes and all those streaming sources, the Amazon Music, all that stuff. So,
and folks,
such a pleasure, though, Daniel.
And folks, you got to check out his original music. So it's so unique, heartfelt, and just wonderful to hear your versatility as an artist, man. You kick ass.
That means a lot, man. Thank you, brother.
So bless you. Thank you again for being here. I really appreciate it.
Of course. All right, buddy. We'll stay in touch.
I will. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you again for being here on the Daniel Hendrick Experience every Sunday, interviewing opera superstars like Ben Gully. Hey, if you want, go to my website, danielhendrick.com, and you can see all of the interviews there with famous opera singers around the world. And while you're there, click on the book, Know You Know, and you can pick up a copy of that from Amazon. That tells the story of me losing my voice and getting it back and singing all over the world. Anyhow,
I'm picking up my copy ASAP.
Hey, dude, you send me your address and I'll send you a personal copy.
That'd be amazing. Yeah, yes, please.
Yeah. So anyhow, folks, until next time, God bless. See you then. Jacob.